lately in PHP Podcast Hangout. This is episode 41, and this will be a special episode because I have here with me a couple of guests, very experienced in the security world. I'd like to introduce Chris Cornett, because he's a well-known figure from the PHP world, from the phpdeveloper.org fame. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a bit hot over here. Here in Brazil, it's the heat season and the rain season at the same time. And I'm kind of all wet in my arms, but I have a fan on my side. I hope you are not listening to the fan. Anyway, other than Chris, also you have a very special guest, Jim Manico from the OWASP. Hello, Jim. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing today, good sir?
I think we will have a great show, and there's a reason why I invited these guests to this show. As I mentioned, they are experts in the security world, and this all ties into the event of the attack to the PHP.NET site, about which we will comment a bit ahead in the show. And as always, we have quite a good, interesting topics to cover. I have focused especially this edition about security topics. The only really non-security specific topic, and probably maybe still related, is about the latest releases of the PHP 5.5 and 5.4. Let me just share the screen here. And on the side, okay, I think I need to increase the font. So basically, there was the release of PHP 5.5.5. It's the usual batch of bugs that were fixed. I don't know if there was any of these that is security related. And also there is a release of 5.4.21, which is basically seems to be a similar set of bugs that were fixed. Chris, did you follow this release? Are you using the latest PHP releases, or you usually wait until it becomes more stable, so we don't get caught by the latest bugs?
Usually, it's more of what's required by the company or by the project. I think the highest I've used so far is 5.4, but yeah, I'd like to use 5.5, but you just can't roll it out, you know, whenever I feel like it, unfortunately.
it's up to your company to decide, or you don't have a say on that.
Well, it's not the easiest thing to shift major versions.
Right.
A lot of planning involved.
Right.
As we say in the Java world, write once, debug everywhere.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right. Yes, I also have a somewhat similar phrase, is that a new version is new bugs. So you probably are using a newer version without some of the old bugs, but you will get caught in new bugs and you still don't know what's worse. Anyway, Jim, are you following the PHP releases in terms of security aspects?
Well, look at that. I saw a validate URL. Can we take a look at that one? That looks interesting to me.
Yeah, let me share.
Let's share that one up there.
And share the screen again. Validate URL. Yeah, I think it's a flag. Yeah, it's security related.
Yeah, think of like different social networks where a user posts up a URL as part of their message. I think this is one of the functions you may want to use to check if it's a valid URL or not. Anytime I see validate anything, that's something that we might use as a security control. So
yeah.
Let's go take a look at that. It fully rejects qualified. I can't read this. So let's.
Fully rejects fully qualified domains.
Oh, here we go. I'm on my cell phone being driven around downtown Houston. It seems to work right now. So I'm like, I'm on the move on this podcast. I'm on my little iPhone here.
Yeah. It's
oh, there we go. Challenge. Perfect. Fully rejects qualified domain names, even though parsed URL parses them. Oh.
Yeah. I was trying to go through the pull request on it and figure out what the difference was. It looks like they're just using two different RFC definitions for it. So it looks like they may have just merged them.
Yeah.
I don't know why they would have used two different ones.
Well, I was not even aware of what is this syntax of the domain with a dot in the end.
I thought PHP was renowned for having like 10 functions that do the same thing in a slightly different way.
Well, sort of.
Well, so parse URL is getting the pieces of it. This filter one that it's referring to is specifically about data filtering. So it's
right.
Kind of the same functionality, I guess.
So maybe one just validate. Does the validate URL function use the parse function maybe as part of its operation?
No, I think there were two different pieces.
Okay.
The filter validate is part of the filter var function.
Gotcha.
It's just one of the filters that can apply to it.
Now, when I have a validate URL function, I want it to be actually pretty strict. I want to be able to ask questions of that function, things like, is it an HTTP URL? Am I allowing HTTPS URLs? Am I allowing FTP or JavaScript URLs? I also want to ask if I would allow relative path type URLs. And so I like those options. These are functions that I need to do validation. And if they're in the language with enough configuration natively, that's ideal. Usually we have to use some kind of third-party library to get some of the extra validation features.
Yeah. Well, personally, I'm still stuck with regular expressions. For some reason, I feel more comfortable with the since they work in the older versions. So I think in my URLs that I validate, I do not even accept one domain that ends with dot. I don't even know what is the meaning of that, but okay, since it's not a regular type of URL, I would not accept it.
Yeah,
well,
I
anyway,
think that was the whole debate.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anyway, well, moving on with the podcast, there's not much to say about these latest releases. Probably there are some related topics with security, but it's not easy to figure all them out. Anyway, moving on to the Hangout, now talking about there is a proposal here to make TLS peer verification on by the... This is the proposal. I don't know if you... Jim, can you read it?
Yeah, very, very well.
I don't think it's very secure to try to read the screens and drive at the same time, but okay.
I am not driving. I am a passenger. Kyle, say hello.
Oh.
So I'm a passenger, so I am
you
on the move.
Me. Well, anyway, regarding this is a proposal that's still under the discussion, and I think most HTTP clients in PHP would not enable the TLS verification of the peers. I mean, verifying for the peers is really what it is, and probably that could cause some security issue. Like,
so this is when using PHP as a client language, and it's about client-side cipher support.
Yes.
Oh, like because it's like calling out to a web service or something of that nature.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. If you do not verify the peer, I think you are vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks, I think. Because you are not verifying if the certificates of the server are valid and so on. That's what it means.
Yeah, it is.
Not easy to do correct at all. Any kind of applied crypto is brutally complex to get right. So ideally, you can find some kind of wrapper class that does this for you really well. And especially if it's an application where you're spending money, I wouldn't mind, you know, even buying a paid-for component that was well enough supported. This is really hard stuff to get right, unfortunately.
Yes, well, the PHP supports it, but I think at least when you use the curl extension, there is an option to do this.
Yeah, there is. The RFC for this is actually proposing it to be implemented down at the stream level, which would go even lower than like the the socket open and all that kind of stuff. That's the base level of any of those requests. So it would be better to implement it there than necessarily trying to. I mean, you could use a wrapper, like Jim was saying, but this would have it a little bit more lower level into the language.
I got you.
Yeah. Well, I think at least for more security-sensitive sites, this should be a must in terms of securing the application, because you could be retrieving, accessing an API that probably it's a fake API with a man in the middle attack. So that
there was actually
one thing you can do to help detect fraudulent certificate-based man-in-the-middle attacks, like when someone has a private certificate to a certificate authority and can make fraudulent but CA-validated certificates, you can use a technique called certificate pinning. This is just taking the public certificate of your SSL server and hard coding it in the client in some way. And then when you make your SSL handshake, if someone hands you a fake version of your website, but a CA valid one that your client would normally validate, it would detect this and reject. This is called certificate pinning. It's a little off topic. I don't see it in the patch or the problem here, but it's something to consider to make your client side connection stronger. And it's not that difficult to implement.
Well, I did not even follow all you said because I'm not familiar with it.
I think the way they're talking about implementing it would be easy enough to do that kind of thing, because essentially you're just defining the certificate as a part of the actual request. So I don't think it would be overly difficult to do that kind of thing.
As an OWASP resource, we have a guide called the OWASP Certificate Pinning Cheat Sheet, written by Jeffrey Walton. Something that worth reading if you really need super locked down client side TLS type of services.
Right. Well, I think I'll look it up and put it on the show notes, because that's always interesting for security sensitive applications.
Yep.
Okay, and this was one proposal that's still under discussion, and now moving on to another topic. So it's more at the PHP source code level. Let me share the screen here, which is, I don't know if this is really exploitable. This is a message in the PHP internals from Jordi Bogiano from the Composer fame. And, well, this is not related to each composer, but it's related with namespaces. Because namespaces, separators, eventually turn into directory separators. And if you have, I don't know how, probably read from some variable, some names. Some namespaces with a dot dot, you probably can make the PHP code load some class that is actually some malicious code that can perform an exploit.
Right. So the basics of this, the idea I think that he was trying to get across is a lot of the autoloaders will just take the path that's being requested and take the namespace and flip it and make it into directory separators. If somebody uses like a getvar and puts in something that's not filtered, and the script uses that as part of the path or as part of the namespace, there is the possibility of a dot dot slash or whatever making it in there because it's not validated.
Is this used, like when I type a URL into a browser and send it to a PHP application, is this function parsing that URL in any way?
No, this is not really an URL. This is There is in PHP in the latest versions there is the concept of namespaces, so you can organize your software in packages, and a package could contain many classes, and they will be included in its own namespace. And if you define a namespace that has a name probably defined dynamically, eventually from a non-secure source of a value, like for instance a GET or POST request variable, it could sort and inject these malicious paths that could make the PHP code load some malicious class instead of the real class that was supposed to be loaded. But this is quite of an unusual case because, well, who would actually define the namespace of the classes to be loaded dynamically from some unsecured source of value. Well, I don't know.
But it can be done. That's the problem.
Right.
So this is like preventing
when,
it.
This is like when untrusted data is concatenated to this namespace in some way and then sent to the autoloader. That's the problem. So we want the low-level PHP APIs that do this to be secure by default in some way. They've added some defense into this low-level API.
Right, but the tricky part is these same require statements that are usually used for the autoloaders do allow they do allow the dot dot slash and all that because they're requiring file path.
Gotcha.
So it would be a little, I'm not sure how you would even implement it at the base level. You'd almost have to do it in the user land code and have it actually check for that kind of stuff before you do the require or the include.
Right. No. Well, this is sort of unusual, but as Chris said, it's possible. Well, the proposal here is basically to have some control on the PHP side to prevent accepting dot dots or any names with dots or only dots. Because dots are the ones that change the current path to some other directory. Yeah.
And, it's like somebody was talking about whitelisting of class names and all that kind of stuff, since there are only certain characters you can use in PHP class names.
Right.
I don't know if any RFC ever came out of it or not. I didn't see one.
Well, maybe this is not a big concern, but it's still yet another possibility of exploit that should be closed just to prevent that some careless programmer uses it and causes some security problem.
I think, you know, just advocating good use of that kind of stuff in the user land code would go a long way. I don't know if it necessarily needs to be something implemented at the language level, but you know, trying to protect developers from themselves only goes so far.
Yeah. Well, there are many of the advances in security terms in PHP were to protect that the developers do the wrong thing. So yeah. I think this would be another one. Okay, I think Jim dropped his connection.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be back.
Yeah, well, it was quite amazing that you actually made it. Oh, there he is.
There he is.
And you're back.
Speaking of which.
The now driving down the highway didn't stop me, but the elevator did. Fair day.
Yeah, we figured.
That explains it. You did not miss much. Just now we are going to move on to the next topic, which is this time related with a something that was not even aware that it existed, which is, I think it's a tool called Coverity that is used to scan code. In this case, it's C code. And I don't know, but this seems like a commercial tool that the PHP core developers have access to audit the PHP project code, and this is a message from Rasmus saying that it is reporting some defects. Well, this is for those that are more acquainted with C programming that goes on in the PHP implementation side. And
it looks like they've been using it for quite a while, actually, because I'm seeing messages that go back to like 2006.
Right. Rasmus is mentioning there are new defects. It seems there were also old defects.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It's good to know that this is a sort of concern with preventive security. Because if this tool is reporting some defects, probably those are potentially sources of security exploits, I think.
Looks like dead code, unused code, all that stuff that needs to kind of come out.
Right. Jim, do you know this tool, Coverity?
Well, before you just say it needs to go out, the code needs to be reviewed. More than anything, the vulnerability report needs to be reviewed and triaged by a security expert. Because most static analysis and dynamic analysis tools have some kind of false positives. So I don't want to take these at face value. I want to go in and look at them, investigate them, you know, test out certain areas. Code does some very strange things. There's different ways to hop into code that a static analysis tool may say is dead. That's really not for some other bizarre reason. So we need to analyze. We don't want to rip the code out. We want to do our proper analysis before we make those decisions. So maybe they're there for good reason. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, it's good to know, but for the most of us, the PHP developers that do not work with the core, this is out of our jurisdiction, I think. But it's good to know that it exists. They are having some serious concerns with the security of the PHP implementation.
Some quick things for C++ developers. Another OWASP cheat sheet. This is a nonprofit free guide from Jeff Walton again. It's called the Toolchain Hardening for C++ Programmers to use certain compiler flags in build environments that gives you maximum security in the build environment. So I would love to do deeper analysis of what's really happening here and how they're building PHP from C. But definitely want to use these kind of tools in the development of that kind of code for certain.
Right. I'll also mention about a somewhat similar tool, but it's more at PHP source code level, but we'll get there. So now moving on to the next topic, always related with security, is about related with a PHP function, session regenerate ID. Let me share the screen here if you can read it. Basically, this is a function that makes PHP switch to the a new session ID. I suppose that when this function is used, they also switch the identifier of the cookie that identifies the PHP session.
When it changes the ID, does it make the older ID invalid as well? Or is this just another session ID for the same session?
That's the topic here. Because this function takes a parameter that if it is false, it will not delete the old session data. And the poster here, Yasu Ogaki, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name right. Please excuse me, but it suggests to turn it on by default.
Now, wait a second. This one is saying whether or not it deletes the old data. Now, that's important, but I also want to know if it invalidates the old ID. There's a vulnerability session fixation, so when a user authenticates, I want to invalidate the old session ID and regenerate a new session ID, but I might want to maintain the same session state or some of the session state or just add to the old session state with authentication data. But the most important security thing for me is whether the old session ID is still a valid ID, whether or not the data cache at the session is wiped out or not. Make sense?
Right. No. I did not double check on the documentation about this. I think if the old data is not deleted, the previous ID is still there as a file, the file name, because by default PHP uses files to store session data. And in the case, I think the old ID probably remains valid for a while, but I could be saying rubbish, could be totally not this. I don't know. Do you know any more details about this, Chris?
I was looking at some of these comments. It looks like when it is regenerated, well, it's hard to tell. I know it does create the new ID and it copies over the session information to that new session, but it doesn't say if the garbage collection for the actual session handling happens right then, or if it relies on the garbage collection for whatever's, you know, storing it, whether it be the file system or memcache or whatever it is.
Right, because there is also the garbage collection process that after a while it removes the old...
there it is right there. Yes. The delete old session parameter, it says whether to delete the associated session file or not. So yeah, it would invalidate the session and it would invalidate the file, removing, you know, file, memcache record, whatever, however the handling's set up.
And, that means the old ID would no longer be valid when you wipe out the session file.
Yep, exactly.
That is the session ID, like entry in the hash table or whatnot that looks up the session. Yep. So yeah, when you want to do session... why would you ever want to do this without wiping out the old session? I can't think of a reason.
Right.
So you want to does this default to wiping out the data when you don't set the parameter?
Right.
No. That's what this proposal is about. Right now, it's set to false by default because of an old deprecated behavior.
Default to when you don't set parameter.
I think we lost him. Oh no.
No, we like default secure defaults.
Yeah.
So we want this changed, even though it will make like everyone's app all buggy and crazy.
Right.
Depending on
the joys of hotel Wi-Fi.
We want to err on the side of secure defaults.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right.
And I think he definitely has
3G,
a point.
I'm on 4G right now.
Okay. Maybe Wi-Fi is more secure.
It's kind of cutting in and out a little bit. Not as good as when you were in the car.
Maybe the structure of the hotel is preventing the signal to get
you. Strange. I'm gonna jump on hotel wireless. I'll be back.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see if it works. That's quite an insecure step. Talking about security. Well, anyway, as we were talking, I don't know if this... the problem, at least for me, is that I'm guessing many things here.
Even though I'm using Hotel Wireless, I'm using HTTPS.
Well, good.
Okay. Makes sense. Can you listen? Are you still there?
Yeah, he's...
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you guys loud.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
It was funny because it seems that you
charge. Keep going.
It seems the video is a bit delayed. At least your video is a bit delayed when compared to the audio. But okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
That should be fine. Okay. Anyway. Regarding the topic of having security by default, this has always been as far as I can remember, a great struggle between the PHP core developers and the security experts. I think it was Stefan Esser, if I remember correctly, that sort of was always fighting the PHP core developers because they were opposing to change things that could break the compatibility and could cause more trouble than that it would actually solve. It would be more secure, but it would also break the PHP applications. And
potentially.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot more people that are more involved in, you know, working with the core that are a little bit more security-minded, I think. You know, people are realizing that there's certain parts of the core language that, you know, they need this kind of work on it. You know, a lot of the RFCs that have come up lately have been more about, you know, preventing bad default behaviors. And it's good to see. I hope the trend continues.
Right. Trying to fix the programmer without rebooting the programmer. Reprogramming the programmer. Because there are programmers that are sort of hopeless. Okay. Anyway, this was an interesting topic, and I'm not sure if it's still under discussion, if I'm not mistaken, and probably it'll they will get to a conclusion, because there are some people that are opposed to changing the default. Maybe they will change the default to the next major version, like 5.6 or something. So by then,
it's
nobody...
Like, right now, the RFC is still under discussion. Right. I don't think they've put in any voting on it yet. It would be included in 5.6 if it gets out there. So
yeah, well, that's usually what happens.
Yeah.
At least nobody cannot complain that they are not doing anything to make PHP more secure by default. Well, anyway, moving on to the next topic. Actually, it was something that I added later to the list of topics, which is a debate that goes on and on the Webmaster World forums. Specifically, at the WordPress forum, there is a guy here that. Is asking if WordPress is secure or not, and if you feel it's not secure, you should prove it. Well, there is no 100% secure application.
No.
But the question is whether the WordPress security concerns are moving on fast enough, or maybe they lag a bit too much, because WordPress is a widely deployed PHP application, and if there is an exploit, it will certainly affect many, many sites. So personally, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, one of the things, I know they've done a lot of work in recent years about improving the actual security of the core. Now it's, you know, not the most ideal code in some places, but they've done a lot of work on it. And unfortunately, it's gotten kind of a bad rap in the past, because a lot of the problems have been with the extensions to WordPress and the modules that you can drop in there. I'm sure Jim's got horror stories, I'm sure, that he can tell about bad WordPress extensions.
You know, it's more than that. When you say WordPress is secure or WordPress is not secure, WordPress is not a monolithic thing. Not only are there a million different configuration settings on WordPress, but there's also, like you were saying, there's tons of add-on modules written by a variety of different developers with all different levels of assurance. So,
yeah.
So, you know, I'm just saying, when you say, is WordPress secure or not, that's not the only thing that's a fair question. Is the default install
right.
of WordPress of a certain version secure on this OS with this level of security patches and right. configuration? So it's a complex question.
Right. Maybe the question should be, is there any effort to audit the security of the plugins, at least those that are listed in the WordPress repository? I know that's kind of an impossible mission, because there are many, many thousands, but at least the most popular ones should probably deserve more attention. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but I've seen somewhere that there are services for installing WordPress plugins that they actually do the auditing. I don't know if it's the auditing of the security or the features. Because there are some plugins that they are not insecure, but they do some things without the permission of the developer. I've read, for instance, about plugins that plant links to the sites of whoever developed the plugin. So the plugin developer earns certain links that probably are worth some benefit in terms of Google ranks, but those are not really secure concerns, security concerns. But the it's always safer to get plugins from somebody that did a serious effort to at least audit. At least a good part of the code.
It's really hard to tell that stuff, though. Even and you know, honestly, there's some plugins out there that are really very popular and really widely used, but they're, you know, the actual code behind them and all that is just not ideal. And that you can't you can't tell, you know, unless the person has specifically said on the plugin site that, you know, they've actually paid attention to security, that you know, you can't trust it. It's just like any other third-party library. You have to go in, you have to evaluate what it's doing, and be sure it's not, you know, hiding the malicious links in there, or hiding, you know, random stuff in your pages.
Yeah. I'll tell you this, I'm not going to use WordPress for, like, enterprise software to run my business. I'm going to put it out there for a marketing website. I'm going to keep it isolated, back it up regularly, back off the server, and assume it's going to get owned and be ready to deal with
it. Yeah.
So, Jim, would you use Drupal then?
Pardon me?
I said, would you use Drupal then?
Look, I don't want to, like, no.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
The White House used Drupal. Drupal, and they pull that thing down really fast. Look, it is what it is. I can do some really nifty things with the different PHP CMSs really fast, but I'm not going to put ultra-sensitive data into it. I'm going to back it up and pull the backup off the server. I'm going to isolate it from other parts of my enterprise and assume it's going to get owned, because there's so many developers who've written code that drives the heart of Drupal and other systems, and I don't know. The security, is it getting better? Sure it is, but you know, I'm going to use it for lower risk things. That would be my choice.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing perfect, so it's probably a discussion that would not lead us anywhere. But okay. Well, so the answer to whether WordPress is secure or not, it's that. Don't ask that question. Well, anyway, moving on.
One more thing. So my buddy Robert Hansen, RSnake, who I work with, he ran WordPress running hackers.org for a long time and minimally got owned. And he did all kinds of crazy things to make it locked in. So I think you should go and hunt him down. Just send a roving reporter to his house. I'll tell you where he lives. And just, like, interview him on the spot how to, like, lock down WordPress, and I bet he can give you a really good answer.
I'm sure he'd appreciate you saying that, too. Send people to his house, yeah.
But the key thing is, when he did describe it to me once, it's not a small effort. It took gargantuan steps to really lock down WordPress.
Yep.
So let's go hunt down RSnake. If I was in Austin right now, I'd just immediately drive over to his house and, like, knock on his door and ask him, but oh well. I'm in Houston.
Okay. Also related to this topic, the next topic is about tools that eventually could help to detect security issues with PHP code. I found this announcement here from a company, White Hat Security. I'm sure there are probably other companies with their own products that probably do a similar thing. But
a second. Hold your horses. I am one of the vice presidents of White Hat Security. I am very biased, and I don't want to give you I don't want to do a sales pitch on your podcast.
Oh, that explains your picture. It was one of their pages.
No, I don't think it is. But if you see my picture there, let me know. I want to see it. But yeah, I do work for White Hat, which means there's no way I can objectively talk about this, right?
Well, you could fill us in a little bit more on the support, possibly.
All right. Yeah.
What does this tool do for sure? I suppose you know it in detail.
Do you really want me to talk about the product that I work for at White Hat? Look, I'm part of, like, the sales team, part of the marketing team. And I didn't come on your. I don't want to, like, go on your podcast to, like, sell product. But if you want me to give you a quick little blip at what it does, I'll do it. But I'm taking off my objective security professional hat, and I'm putting on my sales prostitute hat. If that's what you want me to do, I'll do it.
So it's just to tell us what it does. In a few phrases.
I'll do a few phrases. This is the brainchild of Eric Sheridan and Jerry Hoff, who started Infrared, which got acquired by White Hat. This is the Sentinel source product, PHP source code review. It's not really a tool. It's a service. like you deploy a virtual machine of our engine in your environment. It checks out the code every day, scans the code on-premise with 9,000 plus rules and counting, sends the results back to White Hat, or a SaaS-based service. We review the results, and then we pass back verified results, so there's no false positives. Like, remember earlier with the Coverity issue? It found bugs in the core PHP. Now, they might be real. I'm not dissing Coverity, but you still need to triage those vulnerabilities. So part of White Hat service, we do the triage. And do it like for a year subscription, so it's constantly grinding, scanning, verifying every day, and done.
Yeah.
Well, is it just static scan or is it dynamic scan too?
You know, you're going to talk to Jerry.Hoff at White Hat.
Come on, come back to us, Jim.
Questions. So I'm going to get everyone, just hammer him with questions. Jerry,
and of course, I think you're going to have to put that one in the show notes.
Yeah. It's the censorship.
O-F-F at White Hat. So that's my quick pitch. You're welcome to chop it up, but I'm really proud of what Eric and Jerry have done at White Hat. So I give them a lot of props for building this. This is pretty cool. This is good stuff.
Well, and the more things like this that can be offered for PHP and PHP applications, the better. I mean, I know there's tons of tools out there, but you know, the more offerings, the better.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, two disclaimers. First, I was not even, I seriously not aware that you were working for that company. I added this topic late to the topics of the Hangout, so you probably did not see it. The other disclaimer is that the part that you're trying to mention, the email address of the person that I should contact, the audio come all garbled, so it was not my fault. It was not my censorship. For some reason, it stopped working.
I didn't come on your podcast to sell product. You're welcome to cut that section out.
No. It's always useful.
Let's go. All right, next topic.
Okay, the next topic is... I wanted to move on to the topic on which we'll talk about the PHP.NET security attack, but then I remember there is an article that is interesting also related to security, which is in the JS classes site. Stop the screen sharing. Let me get back to that. Okay, there it's back. Okay, this is an article written by Jason Gerfen. He developed a JavaScript component that uses cryptography to store values in local storage or cookies, which are basically containers that can be used to pass information to the server or also to the next page and JavaScript applications. So he has written this article. The title is Protecting Browser-Side User Data in JavaScript Using Cryptography with Sextor.js, which is his component. And basically, it tells how the component works and how we use cryptography to store the sensitive data on the browser side. For those not familiar, local storage is a sort of a area on the browser side that applications can use to store additional information. It's not like cookies that go back and forth between the every request sent to the server. I think this is interesting, but I was not even sure exactly where did the key to encrypt and decrypt the data would be stored, because I suppose it's not also on the browser side, because it's also on the browser side, it probably will not be secure as well, because an attacker with of the machine where the browser is installed would have access to all the information needed to decrypt the this eventually sensitive data. I don't know if you guys have dealt with applications that use local storage to store sensitive data. Any experience of with this?
No, not directly.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is interesting. We even also comment on the JavaScript Hangout more about this, but it's basically what I said. It's interesting, but it would always be good to analyze where the key to encrypt and decrypt data would be stored. And well, this is just a brief mention about this article. Whoever is interested about this, also the browser side, not just the PHP server side, can take a look and eventually learn what JSON has done with this component. So now we are finally moving on to the topic that is probably what is more intriguing related to the security in the PHP world, which is the one related with the attack that happened. I was even trying to look here the exact date, but it was like last month, 24th of October was...
Yeah, it was either the 23rd or 24th. I don't remember what day it was actually reported, yeah. But they first gave the status update on the 24th.
Yeah, right. And here in the still on the homepage of the PHP.NET site, they are basically saying that they are still analyzing what happened. They found out a few servers that were compromised and they were replaced to be analyzed. And at least until now, I don't think there was any result coming from whoever analyzed this. Even if they reached to a conclusion, I'm not sure if they will announce it publicly soon. I don't know. Chris, have you followed this? Do you have any more news regarding this attack?
No, nothing I've really seen, nothing other than what they've posted. There was a little bit of discussion on the mailing list about it, but... You know, like I mentioned earlier, there really hasn't been any official post-mortem on all this stuff that I've seen yet.
Yeah.
I know everything's back in business from what it was. But,
right. Yeah, they just replaced the servers and moved on, but it would be interesting to know what happened. What we know so far is that there was a JavaScript file that I think it was loaded from static.php.net that got replaced by the attack. And this is curious because some time ago it also happened to... I think it was PHP classes that had one JavaScript file replaced. I reach a conclusion how that happened, but I tried to at least verify if all the versions of the software that I was using were up to date. But in the end, I did not get to a conclusion. Jim, does this scenario ring any bells? Do you have any clue what could have happened there?
A website got hacked? I'm so surprised.
No, I mean, in this particular case of PHP.NET.
JavaScript malware? The question is, how did the JavaScript malware get on the site in this attack? Was it like the servers rooted through a traditional attack at some missing patch? Or was it cross-site scripting because, you know, maybe some admin was popped and some cross-site scripting entered the site through an admin console? I'm curious how the JavaScript got there. I can talk ad nauseum what JavaScript malware can do. Well, we can redirect the user. We can conduct port scans against their client. We can steal their session. We can deface the site or steal data off the page or set up keystroke loggers in JavaScript. Once you get JavaScript on the web page, that browser is yours. You own the browser as the attacker. So that's pretty nasty. No wonder why they took it down and it took it down for a while and fixed the problem. So that's my question. Can you scroll up? How did the JavaScript malware get there in the first place?
Right. That's the answer that we don't have yet. They are still analyzing it. And since they are still analyzing what can, the only thing you can do is to guess. So I was wondering if this is a pattern of an attack that you know, that is familiar to you, replacing a JavaScript on a static server that is running Nginx, I think. Does it ring any bells, or maybe it's too generic?
There's a couple ways JavaScript can get entered on the site. You know, suppose someone has a administration console that lets them update the front page of a website. And you might just give that administrator a big text area, and they can type in whatever HTML they want. But that's a highly elevated, privileged user who's not going to enter an attack when he submits new content. So we give him admin access, a big open text area, and let him submit whatever markup he wants. And that might be safe for a while because, again, only trusted users have access to this feature. Now, supposing I set up a fake request that auto-updates the content if I was the administrator and I put it on my evil website. Now, that's no good because I'm not logged in. But if I can trick the admin while he's logged in to visit my evil web page, that's called cross-site request forgery, then I can make a submit into the administrator's update field. He's probably using a standard CMS, and I add the JavaScript malware that way. They see it and take down the site. Like you said, I'm guessing, and I haven't done a lot of research on this. From what they said on the site there, they don't know how the JavaScript malware got there either. Or maybe it's like that was a chat feature or an advertisement was on the page that had JavaScript malware on it, or someone attacked the server at the network level and got a rootkit or whatever you network attackers do, and from that point they just updated a JavaScript file. Or there's so many different ways that JavaScript could have gotten on the site. Who knows?
Yeah, so no help from the hinders.
Was there an advertisement widget on this page in any way?
No. No, the one that ended up being on the page, the malware that was there, was they said it was appended to another JavaScript file. It was already being downloaded, like a userprefs.js or something. I forget what it was exactly.
Oh, so someone modified an existing JavaScript file, added the malware to an existing JavaScript file, and then served.
Yeah, they've actually, on the SpiderLab site, they've actually got a good post. They did it back on the 24th, where they analyzed, they went through and figured out exactly what the malware was and what it was doing, and they even offered some mitigation stuff for it. So
if it was added to a JS file, then that doesn't seem like cross-site scripting, doesn't seem like cross-site request forgery even. This seems more like a lower level attack, not even against layer 7, like a lower level attack against the server, and someone just updated this file.
What do you mean exactly by a lower level attack? Maybe some exploit of the kernel of the system installed in the server, or
not that low, just maybe not up. Let me try this again. Maybe it's not necessarily a web attack layer. Maybe it's an attack against like someone man-in-the-middled some file update protocol like FTP or SFTP or something, or or maybe the server was out of patch and the server got rooted and whoever took ownership of the server decided to serve up JavaScript malware. Who knows? But it's not likely a web layer attack, like a classic OWASP top 10 type of web attack. It looks like a different kind of attack.
Yeah, looks like it's injected on there. And obfuscated, of course.
Right. Well, what I remember, what happened, it was many months ago, and if I remember correctly, it was on a file that was served, in my case, it was served by Light HTTPD. It's the same thing. It's a server that is used to serve only static content, like JavaScript, CSS, and pictures, and Light HTTPD changes the root of the process that is serving the files to some restrict area of the where the files really are, and so I don't know if whatever was the attack could have gone outside that root area. Light HTTPD changes, but okay, that's my case, and it's not necessarily the same thing that happened in PHP.NET.
And, did you see how this was detected? I think that's pretty interesting.
It was detected?
Yeah. Google told the world.
Yeah.
It's the most embarrassing way. Google told Chrome to tell the world that this site is infected.
It's so what I think happened is it wasn't propagated fully, and Google happened to come across the right instance of that JavaScript file and caught it and then blocked the entire PHP.NET domain. The wiki was down, the Git server was down, the website was down, everything was blocked by Google.
Yeah, because I think that probably that file is included from the other domains, not... Mm-hmm. It's not by static.php.net. It's used by other domains.
I assume that Google hit that and said, oh, php.net is serving malware, so we're just going to... Anything under php.net, we're going to block it.
Yes.
They had to get that removed and taken off the blacklist.
Right. This is terrible. Well, other than that, Jim, do you have any advice for us muggles programmers that are not so security experienced on what to do to prevent and also to deal with the situation after it happens?
Well, the key thing to do is have continual rolling backups of your site and those backups pulled away from the web server in a separate backup. Just prepare to get hacked. You're going to get hacked. It's going to happen, especially when you're using some of these different open source tools without a lot of assurance work put in to lock it down. Just prepare to get hacked. Have a rolling backup every hour that migrates that backup file off your server in some way. And I want to cite my sources. I'm reading Dan Gooden's Ars Technica article, Hackers Compromise Official PHP Website, and one of the authors, Gruten, in here, he says that this is not likely someone overwriting the file. This is likely someone who's attacked the web server, and it might be some web server malware that's residing in memory in the web server, probably because of some missing patch, or even if the patch window of the security problem being released and the patch being available. Suppose that window was a couple minutes when PHP knew about it and updated it right away, but that's enough of a window for an attacker to take advantage of the right kind of vulnerability, get malware in the web server, and then that malware from the web server attack updated the JavaScript file and added the malware. That's the that's what I'm reading in the Ars Technical article. The professional who said this was the case, looks like it was from Kapersky Labs, Martin Gruten, who was quoted in Dan Gooden's Ars Technica article. There's all my proper references from that particular idea. So yeah, it's not like what I'm saying is, even it is layer 7, it's application, but it's not like the web application layer being attacked. It's not something a programmer could have done to fix the problem. It's the web server. The problem was most likely patching issue of the web server and the web server getting owned. That seems reasonable with the evidence we're looking at. But who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Well, actually, as even looking here, I remember that somebody ago, not I think one or 2 years ago, has developed a PHP class that would actually scan all the files that you have in on the server, and it would get an hash of each file, and it would regularly verify if the files were changed, so that it would determine if eventually you were hacked and somebody changed the files. Like in this attack, I don't know this if this can be done efficiently when you have too many files to verify. But it's still an idea to deal with a situation where you already found out that you were attacked. So with a component like this, you could be made aware that you were attacked even before Google told you about it, which was the case.
That's not intrusion prevention, it's intrusion detection. at least a year or two when these files are. It sounds like tripwire. Sounds like a tripwire kind of technology. Yeah. That's something you do at the OS level where you get hashes of different files that you do not expect to change. So, yeah, it seems reasonable if set up correctly. Sure, why not?
Right. It certainly follows your advice to prepare to be attacked. It will happen anyway. I'll have to look again because it was even nominated to the PHP Innovation Award that goes on in PHP Classified every month. The idea was unusual, and so it was nominated. But I'm failing to remember the exact name, and I was not able to find it here. But we'll still have to figure what exactly happened, but at least we should be warned and follow your advice to prepare for the eventuality of being attacked, and as you suggested, have backups in place to be ready to at least minimize the damage. At least minimize the eventual loss of having your site down. And this also brings to me one topic that I want to ask you, Jim, is about the defensive security. Very often when I go to take a look at the resources, sites, articles that talk about security, most of the times that I take a look, it's always talking about attacks. It's dealing with the so-called dealing with the attacks, not exactly what you can do to prevent the or at least minimize the damage of those attacks. Do you have any sites that you could recommend other than OWASP that could provide good advice on how to deal with these situations in a more defensive way, not just be concerned with the specific types of attacks, but also what you can do to minimize the eventual damages that can happen once you are hacked?
So there's the idea of being proactive about building secure applications. There are tons of OWASP resources that talk about this. I work on a project called the OWASP Cheat Sheet Series. One of them is a PHP cheat sheet. There's a lot of breakdown. We try to have like a one-pager on every security topic for the software developer, like an XSS cheat sheet, a cross-site request forgery cheat sheet. There's one on all these different topics in application security. Jerry Hoff built a series called the AppSec Tutorial Series. That's a little series with a couple of videos, high-level videos on application security. There's also another nonprofit called SafeCode that Howard Schmidt started. That's just go Google SafeCode. It's a bunch of very high-quality videos, like official SCORM-compliant training modules to let you do go through secure coding education. So those are a couple of free resources I've looked at that help the developer write secure applications.
Right. So on those sites, you would find advices like you, when you mentioned, of having backups ready to restore eventual loss after an attack.
So there's two different like levels of advice. That's more infrastructure. I'm recommending like a rolling backup, like every hour, and that backup file being pulled off your server, sent to another server. Yeah. So if your web server, you know, is hacked in some way, the backups have been pulled off the system. You can go to a backup previous to the hacking incident, fix the bugs, hopefully, and then go live again. The other kind of defensive advice is less infrastructure. It's more how to write software in a secure fashion. Things like input validation, proper password storage, using like Scrypt instead of hashing methods, which are weak. You want to use like an adaptive password storage algorithm. Again, like Bcrypt or Scrypt or PBKDF2 for your password storage. Advice like doing output encoding to stop cross-site scripting. Other advice to use like the synchronizer token pattern. These things are built into PHP usually to stop cross-site request forgery, or doing a frame-busting header to stop clickjacking. And so we have all these different, depending on what level of security and what level of assurance you need, it's still good to be aware of these secure software coding practices. Like, probably the most important one is, how do you write database queries when using, like, PHP, PDO, or other database access libraries? Some people try to stop this with magic quotes. It's not very magic. We have problems with that. So you want to use a technique called query parameterization. That's how you should be writing PHP, the little cheat sheet, the query parameterization cheat sheet. This is a way to stop SQL injection when doing database queries in PHP. So again, look, I like the Safe Code organization, a lot of free videos on secure coding. As a board member of OWASP, how can I not point to different OWASP projects that talk about secure coding? There's even a PHP security cheat sheet that's worth taking a look at. It's in beta, but there's still some good information there they might want to take a look at. There's also Keith Turpin's Secure Coding Checklist project that can help you build secure applications. So there's definitely a lot of resources, and it's becoming where a developer needs to – developers are getting pressured to build secure applications more and more because we're seeing incidents of web hacking on the rise, and the damage being done is also on the rise. So this is becoming a lot more important in recent days. And any questions about secure coding to your audience? I'm always happy to answer questions. I'm jim@owasp.org, jim@owasp.org. And if I don't know the answer, I'll find someone who does. I'm always happy to answer secure coding questions.
Right. Those are great tips, and Dan, I appreciate you if you can pass me the links, at least the most important ones, because you mentioned quite a lot resources to get listed. So it would be interesting if you can pass them. So I put them in the show notes.
I'm happy to.
And okay. And well, we are approaching the end of this hangout, on which basically there are just a couple of regular sections. On just mention a few classes that were nominated to the Innovation Award. This is no longer specific to security. It's just a regular section. And since this hangout is already a bit long, we're just moving on quickly to that. And I'll start. Let me open here the winners. Okay, it's here. Yeah. Let me increase the font here. Well, we'll start by the JavaScript ones. Talk about the JS classes and nominees for the Innovation Award. Specifically, this site is for JavaScript. And we may start mentioning those of that were released in August, and then they were nominated in September, and then in October the results come out, and there were like three nominees. We already talked about this before between me and Chris. Chris, which ones would you like to comment about these JavaScript?
Of the three, the extended number one probably sounds more interesting. Number handling in JavaScript is less than ideal sometimes, yeah. So no, I haven't really gotten a chance to look at it, but some of the description sounds interesting.
Yeah, luckily in the Java world, we have no problems with number handling.
Just kidding. No, this is other Java. This is JavaScript. If you could, okay, I'll try to open here. It's easier than have you figuring it out.
Manuel, what I was trying to say is there's problems with number handling in every language. Robert Secord, a secure coding guru for the C and C++ language, he wants to have a security conference and a huge, like, week-long conference on integers. On integers. He's that psychotic, but the point he's trying to make, is we could have a conference talking about just integers for a full week because it is a complex topic, and most every language has problems with number handling in some way.
Yeah.
So I think there are, at least in C, there are safe number, higher level advanced classes that might be slower, but have more precision when dealing with certain numerics. So that's something to consider.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's a simpler solution. Actually, very basic. It's by the one that Chris was mentioning. It was a component developed by Martin Barker from the UK. It just created an object that extends the basic number object in JavaScript and adds a few more functions that deal with some functionality that very often you need it, but it's not built in, like checking if the number is odd or even, and checking if the number is floating point or is an integer. But this is a very simple component. And the ones that I would like to comment are the other two. There were only three nominees in this month. There is one that that was developed by Mark Rolich from Armenia, and he developed a component that lets you measure areas of page elements on screen. And these are somewhat unusual components, but he developed this component probably to deal with a situation that he faced when developing his own web applications. And other than that, there is also a component by Valurema from Estonia, which is basically one of those components that let you pick dates. In this case, let you pick a couple of dates to define a range, beginning and the start. There are many components that let you pick dates, but this one is for ranges, and it was quite interesting. And this is just to mention very, very quickly that here in the PHP Hangout, we also try to promote some components of the JavaScript site because it's still a younger site and does not have the quantity and the variety of the components like the PHP classes. So now I'll just move on to the winners of the Innovation Award of the PHP classes site, which in August had much more nominees. In this case, there were like 11 nominees. Chris, which ones would you like to comment?
Let's see. Ones were there. I think I was going to look at that SMS authentication.
Oh, right.
Mainly because of the whole two-factor possibilities behind that. The service that it uses is a commercial service, but I looked at it earlier, and they do have a little trial thing that you can try it out if you want to see if it'll work for your app.
Yeah.
For really secure applications, I would not use SMS. It's it does have some problems. Check out, there's another good article about how Twitter rolled out multi-factor. They're using more of secure protocol. It's more of a push notification where you have a private key on your device. An asymmetric handshake is going on between you and Twitter servers, and they give you a push notification of the Twitter app that you just hit OK on. I'm a really big fan. That's real. They really thought out what a secure protocol is when they built that. Sending a 6-digit or 8-digit code over SMS, don't get me wrong, it's a huge step in the right direction, especially for consumer-grade services.
Right.
For really deep security, I think you want to look even deeper, like a dedicated token or the secure protocol that Twitter's multi-factor is simulating through their client. Real quick note, the whole purpose of multi-factor is to stop brute force attacks without having to use account lockout. Normally, you'd write, if you just did password-based authentication, to stop brute force, you want account lockout, where after so many you lock the account. But if I know all your account names or usernames, then I can use that against you. So multi-factor will stop these brute force attacks and you can turn off account lockout in the face of multi-factor, I think.
Right. Using SMS messages seems to be a more popular solution. I was not aware. So you're saying that Twitter uses push notifications? Mm-hmm. to communicate with the user and validate his device, because it's a physical thing to validate his account. So I was not aware of that. It's interesting. Anyway, this component by Andy Dixon from the UK implements something that is generic in terms of two-factor authentication. Well, there are many. There could be other alternatives, but this seems to be quite common. So yeah. It's an interesting solution.
I still give it two thumbs up. It's a step in the right direction. Not enough websites are using two-factor. It's on the rise, and I think SMS is a great first step. It's a great. It's definitely better than password-based authentication by itself. So I'll give it a secure coding two thumbs up. Two thumbs up.
Yeah. Well, that reminded me. So some time ago, my son lost his Google account. And he was desperate because he wanted to pay to play Minecraft, and whoever got his account also took over the Minecraft account.
Oh no!
But
did they build anything? Did they build any cool things with his Minecraft account?
I don't know. I would have to ask him. what saved his account is that originally I informed some alternative address of mine. It was not my son. And I went to look at my archives to find that message, because Google asked when was the account originally created, and I had all the information in that message, and I was able to quickly recover it without human intervention. I mean, I did not talk with anybody with Google. So it was great to know that they have this means to recover stolen accounts, and my son was happy again because he was able to play Minecraft with his original account again. But I still have to go through a separate step to recover the Minecraft account, which was not as easy as Google. Anyway, that was just a side comment. So moving on with the innovation award.
That would be an awesome. Ask your son what kind of hack he thinks this would be. Like, suppose we hack someone's Minecraft account and then just put, like, you know, like bunny rabbits all over someone's castle or something, or like take someone's like big Minecraft like building and paint it all like chartreuse or something like that, and then log out. That'd be you know, to some people that'd be a terrible hack.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. My son was just 7 by then, so I don't know how terrible could it be to. I suspect it was a so-called friend of. He probably asked his password for some reason, and then he had all right. The accounts that he could. And
Then let me tell little Emma, what's your son's, well, whatever your son's name, don't give away your password to anybody.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened.
That's something that you, once in a life you have to tell him explicitly. So it was my fault I did not tell him.
I'll tell
when
him.
He was 7.
How old is he now? How old is he now?
He's 12.
All right. So this is great. We have a security learning moment for your son. Son, don't give away your password. I know your dad told you to share. And with other things in your life, it's good to share. But your password?
I already told him that.
Don't even tell your dad. Nobody gets your password but you. Nobody. Ever.
My mother-in-law used to tell my wife so that you should never trust not even your mother. And she was the mother of my wife. So a mother telling her daughter that she should not trust anybody, not even her mother, it's quite strong advice.
That reminds me of my math teacher. I was taking differential equations, and I was like, Professor, you wouldn't fail me, would you? And he looked at me real, like, evil, and he's like, Jim, I would fail my mother. So, okay.
Okay, now we have gone pretty off topic. So back to the topic of the Innovation Award nominees. Which other class would you like to mention, Chris?
Let's see.
Was it the Kindle one?
Which one? Yeah, the Kindle one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is interesting. Just not related with the security, I think, in any form. It's just to generate
just sounded interesting.
Kindle e-books. This one is from Sergio Villar from Brazil, and it's basically to help composing Kindle e-books with using HTML files. There are probably some security related with the Kindle DRM, but I think this is just a wraparound of the tools that Amazon provides. It's nothing that the class itself controls, because it does not do it by manipulating the files directly. Okay, and now on my part, I would like to comment. This is MySQL cluster import. Is one of the classes that I would like to comment. This one is from Nadi Latif from Pakistan. It's actually it's quite simple what it does. It just generates a shell script to migrate MySQL databases so they start they can work in a cluster. And what it does is quite simple but very effective. It just executes some alter statements. And what was interesting for me is that I was not aware that because I never worked with clusters is that it's just that, just changing the type of the tables. So although innovative, is quite simple, this class. And the other class that I want to mention, let me get back to the list here. Writing applications to process input from the command line shell. This class makes it easy to deal with some common keys like the cursor keys and backspace and the tabs to implement shell-based applications more quickly. Especially those that deal with history of commands, go back to the old command and edit it and execute that command again. So I thought it was very innovative because it simplifies the job of those that need to develop shell applications. Well, basically, for this podcast is all, but... Jim wants to talk about the AppSec event, right?
Sure. The OWASP Foundation is having a conference in New York City, AppSec USA. This is going to be in New York City at the Marriott Marquis, and we'd love to have you there. And OWASP is, of course, a nonprofit foundation. We're a 501c3 not-for-profit in the U.S. We're a nonprofit out of Europe as well. This is in November 18th through 21st. That's this month. And if you like more information, take a look at appsecusa.org, appsecusa.org. And this is an application security conference. There are plenty of sections for software developers that will discuss different topics around secure coding. So I hope to see you there. Any questions, just drop me a line. I'm jim@owas.org. Or you can look online. This is appsecusa.org as well.
Right. And will there be any PHP-specific sessions or just web development in general?
Let me take a look here. So let's go AppSecUSA PHP. I'm not sure, but I'm going to check right now. You can just feel the excitement in the air here, can't you? I'm not sure. It's let me see what we got here. Schedule. Yes, I'm hitting the schedule.
AppSec.org, right?
AppSecUSA.org. appsecusa.org, and we're a web application security think tank nonprofit. And let's see what we have here. There we go. Crypt analysis.
Strange.
Yeah, at 1 o'clock on November 18th, there's the OWASP PHP Security and Role-Based Access Control introduction being given by Abbas Nadieri, who's coincidentally, and he's the OWASP chapter leader in Iran, I believe. And Abbas is also doing the PHP cheat sheet for the OWASP cheat sheet series. And again, on Monday, November 28th at AppSec USA, there's going to be a section. The aim of this session is to introduce attendees to both projects and to get them working on the projects and related activities. We want to demonstrate and introduce the OWASP PHP security project and get more PHP security thinkers to work together to help enhance the PHP security project at the OWASP Foundation. So there's one PHP event. This is more like a workshop going on November 18th. And Abbas is one of the more senior PHP security experts within the OWASP organization. What else do we have going on here?
Yeah. Oh, these are like long sessions, so I think those are workshops, right?
Well, there's the PHP announcement. Again, go look at the November 18th part of the schedule. Scroll down to 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I'm clicking on that link. There we go. Let me read this out. So, and this is a multi-hour section happening from 1 to 5 o'clock on November 18th at appsecusa.org. So the aim of this session is to introduce attendees to the OWASP PHP security project and the role-based access control and PHP project that Abbas is working on. So, so go take a look at appsecusa under the schedule.
Yeah.
And
I'm on the page.
More information. And I hope to see you there. We'd love to have some PHP, deep PHP security thinkers there, so we can take this information about building secure PHP applications and build open source content and open source articles, so we can get the word out to help people build secure web apps as much as possible. Abbas has been doing a lot of work in this area, so thumbs up to him. Hope to see you there.
Okay, that's good to know. Well, this Engato is going to be transcribed and then it will be published. Let's see if it can be announced in time so more people could go to the event. Well, basically we have reached to
awesome.
to the end of this Engato. I'd like to thank you both for coming. I think it was very interesting to discuss these security related topics. In my experience, not just speaking for myself, but security is usually a boring topic for developers because we are not so well aware of all the details. But okay, that's my opinion. But so with more information, people eventually become more interested and for their own sake, at least minimize the damages eventually. Have their sites act. So again, I would like to thank you both for coming. And on behalf of that is all for now. Bye.
Thank you.